Today, for the first time, you will hear directly from a federal air marshal whose wife was labeled a domestic terrorist simply for engaging in protected First Amendment activity. Records show the FBI labeled her as a domestic terrorist for unlawful entry into the Capitol on January 6, but she didn't enter the Capitol. She came for a public support of the president, and they knew it. Her phone location data did not put her inside the Capitol. Facial recognition did not identify her inside. She had no criminal record and no history of extremist views. What they did know is that this Catholic school teacher from Texas supported President Trump and went to Washington to attend his rally at the Ellipse. That was not enough for the government. That was not enough to label her a suspected domestic terrorist. For 2 years, her family was surveilled when they flew. This was not an isolated case. It happened to hundreds of Americans. It happened because the TSA used First Amendment protected activity as a predicate for watch listing Americans. That's unconstitutional, of course. First Amendment activity cannot be the sole basis for watch listing someone, but sole basis is an important caveat, and it's an opening the TSA exploited. Today, we will release internal TSA records that reveal how the agency authorized First Amendment activity to be used to justify the surveillance of Americans with no evidence and no recourse. Using broad and vague authorities, TSA deemed hundreds of Americans as threats to national security simply for holding opposing political views.
All right, so that's just the opening statement of Senator Rand Paul at the Senate Homeland Security Committee, which convened yesterday. That would have been September the 30th of 2025. Now, we talked a lot about Pete Hegseth bringing in military brass and, you know, giving them the what for. That was happening yesterday, too, September 30th. There are so many really effective things happening. For as many mistakes and out-of-control problems we have, there are good men everywhere trying to get things right. And this will affect a lot of you, especially some of you J6ers, who yourself or your families have been placed on watch lists. Now, the one that we're talking about specifically called Quiet Skies with TSA today is not exclusively the one that's targeted J6ers, but we're going to talk about that. I have to tell you right up front, the problem has not been solved. I don't want to give you false expectations, but it's being exposed, and God willing, it will be taken care of. So we're going to be talking today with Tristan Levitt, who is the president of Empower Oversight. Tristan is all about whistleblowers. He's been working with Chuck Grassley, who is the chief whistleblower guru in the Senate. And so Tristan's been working with him for years and now has his own organization supplementing really what these whistleblowing committees are doing. He's doing great work, and he's going to talk to us about not only the whistleblowers that have come forward about Quiet Skies, but all these other agencies. It's pretty interesting, and I don't think you'll want to miss it. But first, well, of course, this is Sandy Rios 24/7, and you know you can call us at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can listen to the podcast on any podcast platform. And you know, and if you're not a podcaster, you can go to sandyrios.com, and it's very simple to listen to it at that point. So you can catch us on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, a whole bunch of other social media platforms. So if that's your favorite go-to, then check them out. If you like Telegram, we're there too. But before we proceed today with the discussion of Senator Tim Kaine's statement, I have to share this with you. Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade in 2022, over 100 abortion clinics have shut down. Listen to that. You know, but here's the heartbreaking part. Now the abortion pill has taken their place. It's being pushed on women everywhere, and it now makes up more than 60% of all abortions. But there really is hope. Every single day, preborn is rescuing lives, about 200 babies every day, by simply loving their moms and showing them their child through an ultrasound. And when a mom sees her baby and hears the heartbeat, everything changes. And here's where you come in. Just $28 provides that ultrasound. Think about it. Less than the cost of dinner out, and you're literally giving a mom and her baby a chance at life and a chance to meet Jesus, which is really finding life in the deepest sense. So I'm asking you personally, will you join me in this? If you just go to preborn.com/Sandy, that's preborn.com/Sandy, it's $28 to provide one ultrasound to one girl to save one baby. So any multiple of that is welcome. And I think most people can afford to give something. Thank goodness the economy is a little bit better right now. So if you can do something to help these kids, I know you want to, just go to preborn.com/Sandy. All right. Well, this is an interesting one, and it's thick with information. If you want to get a pencil and paper, please feel free to do that. Or, you know, this is something you might want to pass on to your friends. I hope that you will share the show with people. That's how we all learn. We were just having a discussion yesterday with some of our friends about the country is divided, and it's generally divided over the way people get their information and where they get it from. And so if you people are watching MSNBC and CNN, trust me, they have a very different view of our country. And so because of that, we have to get this information out, the truth out in any way that we can. I've been dedicated to that for my entire public life doing this, radio and television. And so if you want to share these podcasts, that would be so wonderful. This is one way, because I do have great contacts, and you know that. I've been around a long time, so I know a lot of people that are doing important things. And I try to bring ones that I trust to your attention so that I equip you with information as you make the case with your friends and family, because this is a tough time to do that. We have such divide. All right, so I hope you'll sit back and enjoy today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
In mid-2024, as she grew increasingly critical of the Biden administration and increasingly involved with the Trump campaign, Tulsi Gabbard noticed changes as she went to the airport. She had more screening, federal agents with dogs showing up for her flights. Other federal agents followed her on the plane and reported back on her activity. When I learned of this, I launched an investigation into the TSA's Quiet Skies program and the Biden administration's weaponization of watch lists against everyday Americans. Under public scrutiny, the Biden administration removed now Director of National Intelligence Gabbard from the program, but they spent the remainder of their time in office stonewalling any investigation. Thankfully, that era is over. President Trump himself, a victim of government weaponization, set out to reverse the previous administration's targeting of the very citizens it is sworn to protect. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem has taken decisive action to eliminate bureaucratic obstacles resisting transparency. We are finally getting answers. And now we know exactly why the previous administration fought so hard to keep us in the dark. Director Gabbard was surveilled on at least 5 domestic flights by federal air marshals under Quiet Skies. Internal records for her targeting show her congressional portrait and that she was a former congresswoman from Hawaii. So there was no doubt they knew who they were monitoring. Multiple concerns were raised internally, and one air marshal asked a colleague, "Why the heck is she a Quiet Skies suspect? If this can happen to a combat veteran, a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, and now Director of National Intelligence, it can happen to anyone."
All right, that's the voice of Senator Rand Paul, and that was a committee meeting of Senate Homeland Security yesterday. While Pete Hegseth was across town talking to all these generals and leaders in the military, we discussed that at great length. So much happened, and so I don't want you to miss this one. You know, it's not just Tulsi Gabbard. It was also many of you J6ers who we've talked about, protected, tried to defend you. Many of your lives have been made miserable by your whole families not being able to travel because they're on a watch list. And that's the gist or the guts of our conversation today, but certainly not all of it. And so at this hearing yesterday, this was the particular topic, was getting rid of this surveillance of regular people, including not regular people like Tulsi Gabbard. So one of the testimonials there was from Tristan Leavitt. Now, Tristan is the president of Empower Oversight. I've known Tristan for a long time. And Tristan, first of all, thank you for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Sandy.
You know, in reading your resume, you know, it's interesting to know someone and then read their resume because you always learn so much. And it's a very impressive one. And if you'll just indulge me for a second, I want to give people an idea of what it is that you've done. You're the president of Empower Oversight. It was in that capacity that you were testifying. And before I get into your resume, what is it that Empower Oversight does? What's your mission?
So we are a nonprofit, and we provide legal assistance and I guess kind of other, maybe PR assistance, you might say, but primarily legal assistance to whistleblowers in the federal government. And so you'll understand why as you go back through the timeline. I'll just say it was my first job out of law school working with the Operation Fast and Furious whistleblower John Dodson for Senator Grassley. But so we help people like that, like the IRS whistleblowers on the Hunter Biden case, or several FBI whistleblowers like Steve Friend, Garrett O'Boyle, Marcus Allen. And that's the thing. When people in the government come to us with significant disclosures that we think Congress would be interested in, we want to help them bring that stuff to light and not be retaliated for it. And when the almost inevitable retaliation comes, to be able to fight that back.
I'm glad you did your own resume. I like that. So I want to remind people, because I don't need to tell you, Tristan, the news is coming fast and furious, and people may not remember that what that particular one was. That was under Eric Holder, under Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder. We found out that our own government was running guns, and one of our agents got killed by one of the guns that they had run. Why did they do that? What did the whistleblower tell us about that, Tristan?
Well, it's a lot, an awful lot, and this is, as is the case with so many of these things, we never would have known about it were it not for this courageous whistleblower. And then when he first came forward, John Dodson, others followed suit. But the short answer is stupidity and hubris, right? So, I mean, there are lots of elements of it, but ATF had been criticized, you know, obviously, certainly in the 90s for lots of things, right? The specter of Waco and Ruby Ridge hung over them. And they were criticized by their internal inspector general, the Department of Justice, for not really contributing significantly in terms of big cases to the gun trafficking that was sending so many firearms down to Mexico, where there was so much cartel violence. But so their, again, just ridiculously stupid idea was, well, we're going to just track, we're going to watch them then. We're going to let them go. You know, and they missed the vital step between we'll let the weapons go and then we're going to take down the cartel. There was no connective tissue. You had a couple of people that had, you know, bad motivations, I think, in terms of kind of just self-interest. But generally, it was just a lot of people. We heard there was a lot of criticism of how the kind of main architects of it either were not very smart, or people that signed off on it didn't have a lot of kind of beat cop experience, kind of common sense knowledge to say, whoa, this isn't like walking drugs where you just follow them along. These are guns. And if you allow those to walk, people are going to get hurt, which happened in the droves in Mexico. And of course, ultimately happened at the U.S.-Mexico border in Rio Rico, Arizona, when Brian Terry was killed, a Border Patrol agent.
Terrible. Mistake, I'm not, just a horrible call, and also I think probably done for very, very wicked reasons, but we won't get bogged down on that. I want to go back to your resume. Senator Grassley, of course, is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee now, and he has had a passion about whistleblowers for years. I'm not sure I should be talking to him about where that passion came from, but you went to work for him, and I think that's what I get the impression, that's what started all of this, and some of the other things that you did. You actually worked on the U.S. Secret Service kind of breakdown of misconduct and security breaches. That's not such an old story that people wouldn't remember that, I don't think. But also Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server in her bathroom, I might add, while Secretary of State, and the FBI's failure to hold her accountable, and the politicization at the FBI. Well, Chris Tristan, that's a little bit relevant right this minute. What can you say about that, and when you were looking into that then?
Well, so you're going back a decade, right? And that really was, it's interesting because so much has come up right now about Jim Comey. You look back, and 2016 really was the original sin, if I can take that term and use it in this context, because so much of the division in our country came from how differently they treated the investigation, the mid-year exam investigation, which its own very own name betrays they wanted, intended to have done before the Democratic National Convention in 2016. They were certain that Hillary Clinton was going to become the president that year, and how they treated the Crossfire Hurricane investigation into Donald Trump. And so we, you know, this was not that clear back at that time, but we were investigating Andrew McCabe, you know, as he'd made donations. His wife was a candidate and made donations to the Hillary Clinton campaign. Mm-hmm. We were trying to figure out why they went so easy on Hillary Clinton. And of course, again, in the years that unfolded, it became very clear that two very different narratives were unfolding that year in 2016. So it was, you know, we learned a lot at that time. And but as more and more has come out, the more and more just outrageous it has looked in retrospect.
Yes, like the fact that Hillary Clinton was the architect of the Crossfire Hurricane and was behind all of this. I'm just going to ask you you surely have an opinion, whether you have knowledge or not. Do you think Hillary's going to be indicted for her part in being the architect of that little plan?
I mean, honestly, no, I don't. You know, it's interesting because I noted recently that it was either Brennan or Clapper who had, I wish I could remember this better, but someone had commented saying, even if we had known that she was coming up with this plan, that's not illegal. And, you know, she was not a government official at the time. She was out of government. So it was a very dirty campaign trick, no question. But then it's the FBI that we rely on to sort out, or we used to, you know, some would have said to sort out kind of fact from fiction to investigate. And certainly there's always been allegations of breakdowns at the FBI. And again, some are very kind of longstanding defenders, and others, you know, would say going back to the Church Committee and others, there have been these abuses. But no one would have imagined still in 2016 that you would have such a, you know, just things play out the way they did, where even though Jim Comey was told in the White House about the Clinton plan 2 days after we received the intelligence from another nation who, you know, intercepted it from Russia, who, again, was hacking nonprofits and others and getting this information, that Jim Comey still 2 days later, when he opens the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, never told the team on the ground investigating the knowledge that he had about the Clinton plan. It's just outrageous. And then you fast forward to 2020, when some of the stuff was barely starting to creep out at the end of the first Trump administration, and Comey absolutely, you know, tries to hide his knowledge from the questions coming from Chairman Lindsey Graham, when he says, he asked about these referrals. It's very down in the weeds. I don't know that's the main focus you want to talk about, but gosh, I could talk about that for ages, just the context of that and how Comey, despite the fact that those congressional hearings, that's our best means of oversight. There are some other tools, but, you know, that's one of the places where, you know, the American people are watching. That's where you try and tell that story to them to help them understand the things that happen. That's how our government is intended to operate. And Comey totally obfuscated. And so this ended up as one of the charges that the current FBI and Justice Department tried to bring. The grand jury didn't return that one, so it's a no true bill. And so on that particular thing, that not quite lie, maybe, but again, that dissembling, you know, will have somewhat of a pass. But I think there are strong cases on the other counts. But again, I think they relate to lying to Congress, not necessarily that it was illegal, if you will, for Hillary to do what she did, as despicable as it was.
Back to James Comey, I think this is one of the cases, Tristan, where the congressional hearings really did have impact and get kind of in the bloodstream of Americans, because Comey was such an obfuscator and such a liar, so is Christopher Wray. But we have so many back and forths that are incriminating for him, and I'm guessing that you guys have provided a lot of fodder for the charges that are coming against Comey. But all right, so two things I want to say that you managed to do, because these are important, Kristen. You were part of establishing the Senate Whistleblower Protection Caucus, and also you negotiated the passage of the FBI Whistleblower Protection Act of 2016. So you've really, really poured your heart and soul into this kind of work. I want to ask you, because we didn't even talk about the IRS whistleblowers and the FBI whistleblowers, which we can, but what story, if you were to, you know, be giving a lecture and you were to tell the most compelling story, a shocking story you heard from a whistleblower, do you know what that might be?
Well, it's funny because once they get into the bloodstream of kind of the American narrative, you know, then they almost lose their shockingness. But yeah, if you were telling someone for the first time, and I have, you know, especially in talking to kind of younger people, I mean, Operation Fast and Furious is, I think, the most shocking. I think, you know, the experiences of the IRS investigators on the Hillary or on the Hunter Biden case is, you know, it's hard because they all, you know, they're certainly some involve more money that's wasted or more criminal behavior or more abuses of power. But, you know, each of these different things that whistleblowers bring forward, you know, are important, and they're sometimes important to different groups of people that are impacted by them. So I know that's a very lawyerly answer that doesn't really say here's the top thing. But I mean, you know, I maybe if I were highlighting whenever I finish writing a book, there'll probably be, you know, 8 or 9 different cases I want to look at, and you could kind of whittle it down to maybe the top 3 or 4, but I don't know which that I could say any of them is necessarily the most shocking, because those that were have now been told to the American people, and, you know, they're often very divisive. The more kind of shocking they were, the more inclined some, usually those on the left, were to say, well, I don't believe that's true. And so I think that really has an impact. I'll share one tiny little anecdote that when President Biden pardoned not just Hunter, but then later his own siblings, I had a colleague from high school who I haven't heard from in years send me a Facebook message and say, Tristan, you post this kind of stuff all the time, and, you know, you've always been a right-winger, as she put it. But now that I saw that Biden pardoned his son, I have to ask, so this was true? Is there something to it, that he did something wrong? And I felt like just literally throwing up my hands when I read that, because, of course it's true. We've been trying for so long to get this out. But again, for those that are not, you know, people are in their kind of echo chambers. They believe the narratives they want to believe. And so for a lot of people, some of the stuff was so shocking that they just chose not to believe it.
You know, on a different area of whistleblowing, you know that my husband is a former FBI agent, a retired one. And one of the things that has driven him crazy this last several years is that FBI agents, prior actually to your work, were remaining silent. And he said, how can they do that? They know all of these things. How can nobody come forward? But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, safe to say that your work, these whistleblowers coming out like Steve French and Garrett Boyle and others, they have, how would you quantify the strides that we've made in uncovering the bad stuff inside the FBI have come from these whistleblowers?
I think it certainly has, and I actually would break it down into kind of two parts. That FBI whistleblower enhancement bill you mentioned that we got passed in 2016 was really a passion project of mine, and has been since, because it was a passion project for Senator Grassley for so long. I was working for him, but when the modern whistleblower protections of the modern era were passed in 1978, the FBI got a pass. They were originally, you know, Jimmy Carter is actually the one that sent that up with some other good government provisions, the Inspector General Act and some other things. Congress took that, and the FBI is going to be treated the same as every other federal law enforcement agency. There were a number of others that were already in place. You know, ATF had already been created. The DEA was around. Secret Service obviously has been around for a long time. All these other federal law enforcement components, and it was the FBI that had the heft. It was less than a few years since J. Edgar Hoover had passed away, and obviously he had an immense force in Washington, D.C. And so the FBI at the last minute managed to get this amendment passed that exempted them from the normal whistleblower protections. So they have a totally different process. You know, the other parts of my resume that deal with these agencies that try and enforce whistleblower protections, the FBI historically is not subject to them. And significantly also, they got to kind of set their own rules internally. And so, for instance, up until 2016, when we got this passed, you had to, your disclosure inside your agency was only protected if you could talk to the special agent in charge. And because of your husband, you would know how that is. You say, well, you know, you're a line agent. Well, I want to have a meeting with the SAC. Well, what do you want to have a meeting about? Well, you know, I can't tell you. I want to make this disclosure. Either you couldn't make your disclosure, or if you gave any hint what it was about, boy, they would keep you away from the special agent in charge, absolutely, while they retaliated against you, and then say, well, he never made the disclosure to the special agent in charge. So I think that passage in 2016 was huge, and it enabled people like Steve Friend and Garrett O'Boyle then, especially during the Biden administration, to come forward, and they really did, along with kind of the disillusionment a lot of people had after first on the left after Comey's announcement, but then as all this stuff started happening during the Trump administration, people on the right saying, whoa, 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 the FBI seems very politicized, and suddenly what seemed like a narrative at the top level, seeing what we saw from FBI leaders, became even more real and granular when these whistleblowers said, no, they're investigating Catholics in Richmond, and they are making us go to school board meetings to see who is protesting masks. All of these things, these whistleblowers really helped to expose, again, a very, very deep rot inside the FBI.
Well, and they paid such a huge price, I think. Other whistleblowers were hesitant to come forth. I know you guys have dealt with a lot of others that just once they saw what happened to people like Steve French and Garrett Boyle, who lost pensions, were without work for a couple of years, just were treated abominably. And so now, what's happened to some of those FBI whistleblowers, Tristan? I think some good things, right, now?
Yeah, so we were able to conclude. I will first say during the Biden administration, we were able to help one of them get his clearance reinstated, which was a huge thing, for one, because it was during the Biden administration. But just our arguments just couldn't, you know, they folded to those. But when we did that, we started to get further whistleblowers from inside, like the FBI Security Division, that were blowing the whistle on how those inside the Bureau that want to do the right thing on, for instance, Marcus Allen's security clearance were in turn retaliated against. So that was a huge deal. It got New York Times coverage to have the first whistleblower ever have their clearance reinstated. This year, really kind of a dam broke in a way. We were able to get 9 more settlement agreements with the FBI. Some of them were, again, people who were more prominent like Steve Friend or Garrett O'Boyle. Others were not so prominent. Some of them, you know, one of the whistleblowers is right here in West Virginia with me. CJIS is the facility up in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And it's where so many personnel are who are not law enforcement. And so she never went public with her name, but she was retaliated against for exposing problems there. And she was able to get her retirement. So it was a very good development for certain for these individuals. I will say these are the cases we took on because we thought they were the strongest. There are dozens of other people that in many ways were wronged by the FBI, in my view, but we said, well, there's really not legal recourse, and so it didn't make sense for us to take on those cases. But so others that I hope the FBI is making right, because a lot of them, when we got the settlement agreements announced, you know, that Kash Patel tweeted about, that 10 were happening, and those were all our clients. The 10th one was just a further update on the Marcus Allen case, but a lot of people reached out and said, well, what about me? And I feel really bad because, again, there are some other cases I'm extremely sympathetic to. But, again, the law in this area has been tough for a long time. And even the changes we were able to do, I think what you're reading on my bio when it says negotiated the passage of that thing in 2016 is because it was really what you would call a rump bill. It was a small amount that we were able to get through the House Intelligence Committee without them objecting to, because very large overhauls otherwise – that might have done things like protect people's security clearances, which is still a glaring loophole, we weren't able to get passed into law. So other people have been mistreated, and I hope there will continue to be change at the FBI to get that fixed.
Well, we all do. And I guess the good news is that good things are happening, and I know we started out saying that, and I think it's true. But it's such a mess. They have created such a mess in our country, and it's so tangled and so deep. And yet, people, it seems like people like you, Tristan, are just more and more and more determined to dig down, like Rand Paul in the hearing yesterday. In fact, let's go back to that. That was the Senate Homeland Security Committee meeting yesterday that you testified at, and it was about the abuse, I believe, of the TSA Quiet Skies program. Was it more than that, or was that the gist of it?
It is more than that. They often get confused, but although whistleblowers who came to us last summer exposed TSA using Quiet Skies to politically target Tulsi Gabbard, and because of Rand Paul digging into that after our whistleblower disclosures, learning that it was used also for folks like those who were in D.C. on January 6th, even if they never went anywhere near the Capitol, some of that happened outside of the Quiet Skies program. So a big purpose of the hearing was, even though you know, the snowball that took off after our whistleblower disclosures resulted in Secretary Kristi Noem at DHS discontinuing the Quiet Skies program, there still are a lot of other questions that need to be answered and some abuses that, even if you didn't have a Quiet Skies program, still would have happened. One of our clients who Empower first started representing back in 2022, Mark Crowder, was another witness there. And again, his wife is someone who was there on January 6th to hear the president speak at the Ellipse, but she is partially disabled. She has, you know, she can't walk quickly in any way, and she had no intentions of walking down to the Capitol. And yet her husband, who down in Houston was responsible as part of his air marshal duties for assigning the coverage of, whether it be under quiet skies or under terrorist watch lists, but the coverage of air marshals to go and monitor people, which is a task they started after 2018 that a lot of marshals felt was kind of really over the top, but still that's what they're directed to do by their agency. He discovered that he was supposed to be assigning coverage for his own wife, that she was labeled a domestic terrorist, and that there was a false record in TSA records that said that she had entered the Capitol, which was not true. When he told his TSA supervisors about it, they said, well, the FBI put that record in there because that feeds from the terrorist screening database. And so he worked for 2 years nearly to try and get that off of there. But so, again, ending Quiet Skies was a significant step. It gets a little bit confusing when you get down on the weeds because there's so many different programs, Quiet Skies, Silent Partner, all these other things that could result in special mission coverage. Again, that coverage where you've got air marshals watching you. And but I think the hearing was a good step in exposing how all of these are just so intrusive. One of the things they released yesterday was the notes that air marshals took on Christine Crowder, the wife of our client, when she was flying. And we know it's the exact same sort of thing that they did for others like Tulsi Gabbard, even though they haven't yet gotten the documentation on that. But these notes show them, and in fact, sit down at my computer and read a little of that, but these notes show that they were looking not just at, you know, oh, she got on the plane, does she have a weapon or something else? You see these notes, and it is time-stamped, as they say, at this time she got up to use the restroom. At this time she got onto her phone and was scrolling the news. At this time she talked to another person. At this time she ate some food. At this time, I mean, it's just insane. They detail every item that she had on her. They detail everything they could see in her bag. I think it was literally three air marshals sitting on the same airplane spying on her. And this is after she went through extensive screening, you know, the extra screening you get from having a quad S on your boarding pass was four S's, so that when you go through the initial screening, you have to be patted down and everything else. And then on top of that, when you get to the gate, they do it again. They have a bomb squad come just in case there happens to be an insider threat at the airport who gave you something after you went through initial security. So they do that rigmarole all again at the boarding gate with everyone to see humiliating you. And again, this happened not just to her, but to dozens of people who were there on January 6th in whatever capacity, whether the government knew that they, you know, had been inside the Capitol or not, as well as to others who were targeted. So it just is outrageous on every level.
It is, and I alluded to this in the opening, but I have covered J6 since J6, and I have a lot of people listening who were there, and I've interviewed dozens of them, and I don't know if any of them are not on this kind of list, and even their families. And so they've started driving everywhere because it's the horrible situation that you just described. So I guess in that hearing yesterday, were you able to establish who is responsible for this?
No. This hearing, I am sad to say it because here we are, it's October 1st, and we are, you know, 9 months into a Trump administration, but this hearing was made possible because DHS was only barely getting some documents to Chairman Paul, but there are large amounts of documents that were not produced, and even of those that were, some of them raised more questions than they answered. For instance, there's a whole set of documents that allude to the fact that people who, you know, one part of the documents suggests this. Anyone who took their mask off in an airplane, and Rand Paul did a good job yesterday, as did Senator Moreno. Someone talked about the, you know, COVID not being so polite that it would take a pause while you took off your mask to eat your peanuts. But as soon as you put the mask back on, right? Yeah. Oh, no, you can't take it off.
Totally.
You know, it was a farce, obviously. But there, you know, again, people who would take masks off were put onto a watch list or even not allowed to fly. But it appears from the documents that we have that even people who were connected with a group that protested mask mandates, they didn't do anything specific on an airplane, they were also put onto watch lists, it appears. Or if someone asked for an exemption from a mask mandate at a federal employer. So there's a lot of questions these documents raise. Rand Paul made clear they're not done investigating. Same with the Tulsi Gabbard targeting. The government leaked a lot of information back in January that was supposed to explain away their role in it. And yet, again, it's still left open. You know, frankly, it raises a huge question about, it still makes it look like it was political targeting that she was added the day after she criticized Kamala Harris on Laura Ingraham. And as I described to Laura Ingraham last night on her show, that interview alone seems to have been enough for them to say, well, she's traveling from a foreign country. We're going to say she associated with this person. But Mick Mulvaney, former member of Congress and former director of the Office of Management and Budget, also was there, and he was not added to the program. So it really smacks of political targeting, and there's just so much work that needs to be done to expose this in more detail, because that's how we ensure it doesn't happen again. If you just say bad things happened, good thing there's good people now, we'll move on, that's not enough to stop it from happening, certainly under another Democrat administration, but frankly, some of these things, even under a Republican administration, if we lose sight of how precious our civil liberties are and you know, the trade-offs that we have too often in the past made just to feel like we were safe, that those may not be worth it.
You know, I think the point was made in the hearing that we should make, and that is that they, what the government was doing, whoever they were, whatever agency, I think FBI, Homeland Security too, I'm sure, you know much more about it than I do, Tristan, but they actually used people's First Amendment rights to speak or protest or speak up to punish them, to put them on these watch lists. You know, has that ever happened that you know of in the history of the United States?
Well, the U.S. has a very complicated history, Sandy. I hate to say it. If you could see me here, I'm sitting in front of a massive wall of books. There have been some things like that have happened. I mean, if you go back to the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798, the threat, the fear of getting sucked into a war with France did lead us to crack down. And so we have kind of a complicated history with civil liberties in our nation. You know, and frankly, I'm kind of in the middle. On the one hand, there's times we say, well, you know, again, clearly after 9/11, there was a very high enhanced threat. But, you know, through the decades, there are different times when, because of people's just personal political views, the government has gone after them more. And again, in some instances, whether it was communists or others, then I'm say, well, yeah, that's the price we pay to try and, you know, stay in a free society. You know, and again, people, civil libertarians, strong civil libertarians would challenge the definition of free there. But, you know, I think what I can say to your question is this was an instance where, unlike the usual security or civil liberties debate, this is an instance where there just wasn't any of that tension. This wasn't a fear of actual people causing danger. Like the idea that someone who took a mask off for a second on a plane, the threat on a similar level to someone who might attempt to hijack a plane is just ludicrous. And so to that end, I think that's where this is unprecedented. That, again, it wasn't just about free speech of a sort that, again, can become controversial at times. This was free speech on issues that just are part of the political divide in our country right now. But if you say, well, parents should have a role in their kids' education, or, you know, maybe these lockdown measures are not so effective, or we think people had a First Amendment right to go and support President Trump on January 6th, if they didn't break any laws, what need is there for them to do this, or what, you know, obviously you can, even within the right, people get into, well, what breaking of laws really would justify something like this? Is just going inside the Capitol, is this a proportionate response? So all of that in that way makes all of this very much, I think, unprecedented. It is fair to say.
Yeah. Well, of course, after 9/11, as you alluded, everything did change. It was national security, and we didn't know who was who. And I do, you know, I think Lincoln actually suspended rights during his tenure also, but it wasn't a permanent thing. It wasn't a permanent thing. And so I think, you know, I don't know how you quantify that, but I'm with you that sometimes I think it is necessary. But this is just way beyond the pale. I want to ask you what... Look, these committees in the House and in the Senate, you know, they are tasked with oversight. And I think they've done, oh, I don't know, you know, the jury's out in terms of rating them. But I think some of the committees have been very effective. But what can you do that they can't do? Why is it important that Empower Oversight exists?
Well, to us, the secret is that insiders have the best knowledge. What I learned on Capitol Hill, and it goes again back to Operation Fast and Furious, Senator Grassley sent a letter to the Department of Justice and said, I've heard allegations that this is happening, that, again, the death of a Border Patrol agent may be tied to guns we allowed to go to Mexican drug cartels. And DOJ responded and said, no, that didn't happen. Now, Chuck Grassley may be one of the most underestimated members in all the history of Congress. So when he wrote and said, I have a whistleblower that said this, why they didn't stop and think, oh, this might be proven wrong, but I literally, in 2017, when I worked for Chairman Chaffetz, wrote the report on the internal dynamics of the response. We got all those emails so we could see, and they just didn't take it seriously. So we could see that, you know, I'd send an email, it'd go to some staff, they'd say, oh, these guys just have a political, you know, vendetta, they're trying to score points. They just didn't take seriously what was happening on the ground. And that's the kind of information whistleblowers have. So it doesn't have to be in power oversight. Congress has whistleblowers come directly to them. Sometimes Congress refers to those kinds of people over to say, hey, they need legal counsel. But the secret sauce is the whistleblowers, because without them, as so many people have noted online, Congress can write all the strongly worded letters it wants, and they can even issue subpoenas. But if they don't know exactly what they're looking for, those are really kind of fishing expeditions. And when you've got a whistleblower, you know what to look for. You know what the problems are. And then you can put the lie to whatever types of self-serving justifications agencies give. And they always will. And frankly, Republican and Democrat administrations sometimes do that when they are caught flat-footed on something. But that's why whistleblowers give that extra piece of information no one would know about. If I can make one other point related to that on a different thing you and I have talked about, just last week we released information about a Title IX whistleblower. He's an attorney within the Department of Education, and that's a situation where you had a judge telling the Biden Department of Education, you can't enforce this new guidance that incorporates gender ideology or gender identity into Title IX. Congress didn't have that in mind when it passed Title IX. It was about, you know, protecting women and trying to even the scales there, not about, again, what you identify as or these pronouns or whatever else. And the judge issued that injunction, but internally to DOJ, they scoffed at it. They said, we're going to do this anyway. And so they opened investigations around the country, including places like Oklahoma, the tragic death of a youth there, Nex Benedict, who was transgender, and they really brought the full force of the federal government down on these school districts, scaring them, saying, we're investigating to see whether you did enough to protect, you know, again, transgender rights or these other things. And it's only because of this whistleblower from the inside that we know that they were ignoring a court order and doing this, and they knew they were. The local school districts knew they were under investigation, but what they didn't know was that internally, the Department of Education was using these criteria that they weren't supposed to be using. So even the judge didn't know. And so, again, there's more detail one can share there, but the fact, the overall lesson from that is the people on the inside, they have the best insight, and we want to protect them when they want to come forward and say, no, what's happening here is wrong.
Now, I was just thinking the Justice Department in that case is, refusing to cooperate and ignoring orders. And I was thinking when Eric Holder in Fast and Furious, remember, he refused to testify before Congress, and I think he got held in contempt. And it was like a slap on the hand. It was very, you know, there was just no control, no respect for Congress. And in that regard, Tristan, because you've been in so many of these hearings, I often wonder if these senators and congressmen would be better off. These hearings have become like a chance for the senators and the congressmen, this is nothing you don't know, to sort of show, preen before the camera. And often nothing is accomplished. And sometimes when a witness gives a wrong answer or a bad answer or a lie, they don't even recognize it. They don't know the information well enough because some staffer has written their question. Do you think it would be more appropriate or more efficient, more powerful, if these committees would hire someone to be their legal counsel, to ask the questions like in a courtroom, then rather than have all these congressmen, you know, wax eloquent and are not so eloquently in these hearings?
Yes, is the short answer. They have those attorneys already. Every committee has them. And there was a time, if you go back, I can't remember if it happened during Iran-Contra, but you go back to some of the earlier congressional investigations and you'll see staff questioning, right? Rather than these little 5-minute rounds and everybody does this dance, staff would have an hour to just sit down and grill down. And again, it would just maybe be one or two staff attorneys grilling the witness. And so it has shifted over to, I don't want to quite say that it's like kabuki theater, but it's just so limited
I'd say
what
that.
You can accomplish in that 5 minutes.
I would say it's exactly that.
Yeah.
It's a circus. And you know what? We're seeing how ignorant they almost all of them are. Not all. We've got some stars. But how little they really know about anything. Maisie Hirono talking to Cash Patel. She couldn't even put string two words together. That's the most recent case I can think of. They make fools of themselves, and they're supposed to be governing us, Tristan. So it's pretty distressing, I think.
Well, that's fair. You're getting at the political scientist in me, which would say also, I think the American people bear a lot of blame for that, right? We keep electing people like that. Our own attention spans have grown shorter, and so we elect people that talk in sound bites, right? And so if we don't elect serious people, you can't really, I think the finger might be pointed at us. But, the thing I will say is, even without staff questioning, there are members that do their homework, and again, the format just doesn't really lend itself there. And one of the other challenges, and Fast and Furious was, to me, a turning point, because holding Eric Holder in contempt, it was actually because, not necessarily because he wouldn't testify, he loved to do that, because he could kind of slide his way through the questions and leave without anyone really laying a finger on him, but it was because they wouldn't produce certain documents. And the documents are things that we as the staff would have dug through. But so when he was held in contempt, and Congress stopped about a century ago enforcing its own subpoenas or contempt citations. So now they send a referral over to the Department of Justice in the executive branch. And if you believe in the constitutional separation of powers, you say, well, Congress, the legislative branch, is Article I. They have their own inherent authorities. Why would they rely on the Article II branch of government to enforce it? And so that's what happened, was they sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department under Eric Holder, and shockingly, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia didn't want to enforce that. And so that was the moment that I think it became clear to a lot of us as staff and attorneys and those that watched, that the emperor kind of had no clothes, that in this country, if we are willing to accept a scenario where Congress can't enforce its own inquiries, we're really kind of in a standoff, and that really tips the balance of power in our constitutional republic. And so since then, you can say, if someone's not doing it, I mean, people forget, a lot of the tweets I saw yesterday was, Rand Paul, why is he holding a hearing? Where are the arrests? You say, well, the Constitution doesn't authorize Congress to make arrests. Generally, again, I would say when it comes to enforcing a subpoena, you send out the sergeant at arms and go drag them down to Congress jail, a room in the basement or something. But generally speaking, in terms of holding people accountable for their actions in the executive branch, Congress doesn't have that authority. And even when they try to subpoena documents and other things, sometimes the executive branch just snubs their nose at that. And if we like the cause, if you will, if we say, well, we don't want these Democrats in Congress investigating my president or my administration, some people say, then you have to pause and say, well, you have to realize that kind of still does erode the balance of power in our constitutional republic, because if they can't get at that, then what stops the reverse when Congress is seeking things? You should think that a Democrat president would want to provide. And so, again, Fast and Furious kind of helped to highlight why these hearings sometimes are the only mechanism that we really have. And so, frankly, why go become an expert on something to get your – I've seen some of the best, most tight 5-minute questioning rounds, and what happens from it? Nothing, because, again, we have really misaligned the way that our checks and balances are working right now under the Constitution in a lot of ways.
Oh, for sure. I was just thinking how what's happening from this, even though many of us don't mind this right now, but we are making the Congress, because of their abdication, is creating a very, very strong executive, which some people don't like and the left certainly doesn't like. But in this vacuum of them actually doing something and taking courage and actually accomplishing something, President Trump is forced to do a lot more things that they don't help him do. So it has messed with the balance of power, I think, too, Tristan. Hey, before I let you go, there's one case, and we'll just, I hope to do an entire interview with you, but two of the most famous whistleblowers that you guys worked with and are these two IRS whistleblowers, Joe Ziegler and Gary Shapley, I think. They were incredible. They were incredible. And they just give us the nut of what they exposed.
They exposed that even when they opened an investigation that was a normal tax enforcement investigation, these guys worked for the SEAL Team 6 of the IRS's international tax investigations. And yet when they brought forward just a normal standard case as it related to Hunter Biden evading taxes, not just not paying them, but also lying on his returns, this case was different from any other case. And the supervisors, first said, oh, you don't want to open that. Big cases, big problems. Eventually, the Justice Department, they realized, pulled punches. They wouldn't investigate in all the ways that they would normally for a person like you or me. They didn't do that. And even when they finally got the Justice Department, after they whittled down the scope, they wouldn't investigate President Biden. Even when there was cause to ask questions about his involvement, they wouldn't let them execute search warrants or do these other things they would normally do in any other investigation. They finally got this set of charges that prosecutors said they would support related to Hunter Biden, and then they just languished. And it was because U.S. attorneys appointed by President Biden told David Weiss, the U.S. attorney in Delaware, we're not going to bring your case in our district. And he didn't have authority to do it in his district. And he, frankly, was a chicken, for lack of any other term. So he himself didn't push the Biden administration to say, I need to bring these cases in other jurisdictions. He was just going to let it all die. And that's what these guys exposed. And they got a lot of pushback. They were criticized by the president, by David Weiss. So many people saying, no, this is being portrayed inaccurately. But as we could see from the fact that Hunter Biden's plea deal, which, again, there wouldn't have even been anything, it would have just died off. They came forward, and suddenly DOJ leapt into action with this sweetheart plea deal. But a judge properly rejected it, saying that it was, you know, didn't make a lot of sense. And then, of course, a jury found that Hunter Biden was guilty of these things. And so that all, none of that would have happened. It all would have been swept under the rug, not just what Hunter Biden did, but the various other ties to the Biden crime family, yes, as many have called them overall.
Yeah. The big guy, too. Yeah. So that's kind of the nut of that. And these guys were so articulate and not necessarily conservative. So it was a pretty amazing whistleblower event when they testified. And then they really paid a huge price for that. But as I understand, I believe you said to me, Tristan, that they are back employed. Is that true? Can you tell us what they're doing?
Yeah, they never actually lost their jobs, because as we told them at the outset, this one will be high profile enough that that's probably something that won't happen. And that was true. They missed promotions and other things during the Biden administration, but they never got fired. Then during the Trump administration, thanks to people like Senator Grassley advocating for them, they got brought on as senior advisors to Scott Bessent, Secretary of Treasury. They were also advising the commissioner of the IRS, Billy Long, but when he left the IRS and Bessent became the acting commissioner, Gary and Joe, in many ways, are running the agency, or certainly are helping to run the agency. And so their persistence has been certainly rewarded, and it is really one of the most amazing headlines in my neck of the woods, if you will, that a whistleblower during the Trump administration got put in charge of the agency they blew the whistle on. That has never happened before in history.
I love it. I love it. I'd like to see more of that, actually. I'd like to see more of that, like at Justice Department and other places, but and FBI, too. But anyway, no, I
Absolutely.
Won't go there right now. But all right, so the guys are coming out with a book, which we will discuss. It's going to be the Whistleblowers versus the Big Guy. The Whistleblowers versus the Big Guy, and even maybe some talk of a movie. So this is a big deal, and Tristan's been involved in this for some time. So we're going to talk to those whistleblowers in November, and I'm just teasing you. If you want, can they get the book now? Could people get that book?
You can pre-order. If you go on Amazon, Whistleblowers versus the Big Guy, it's available on there. It's from Hachette Books. There's all other book publishers are linked to on their website. But yeah, November 11th is when it comes, but we would love to have pre-orders, because that's really what determines whether your big bookstores will actually carry it on the shelves or not.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Well, I think in conclusion, what I'm hearing, Tristan, is this: the Quiet Skies program has been shut down. So Tulsi Gabbard is no longer being surveilled, as are some of these others that were with TSA labeled that. But lots of other groups still have these people on lists, and that would include the J6ers, I'm guessing. So that's not solved. Much of this is not saw, but a lot was exposed yesterday. Some of these whistleblowers have been reinstated, as we just talked about the IRS, but not all of them. So it's a work in progress, and the Empower Oversight is really leading the charge on this. One last thing. If there's anyone listening who might potentially be a whistleblower or know of a potential whistleblower, how could they get in touch with you?
Just go to empoweroversight.org, E-M-P-O-W-E-R, oversight.org. There's a contact us form on there, and we go through and review all the submissions on there. So we are very small. There's just four of us that are full-time attorneys. So a lot of people write in with things that we don't have the bandwidth to take on, but we certainly want to give advice and guidance wherever we can. So that's a place people can contact us and reach out to us.
Okay, empoweroversight.org. All right, Tristan Leavitt, president of the Empower Oversight. Thank you so much, Tristan, for all your hard work, your youthful enthusiasm. And actually, I have to say, that's what I think of you. You're always personally empowered. You're just so enthusiastic. It's contagious, and you're in such an important position. So I'm grateful for that, and I want to encourage you in every single way. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, my dear friend. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you.
Okay, Tristan, same back to you. All right, Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Did you know that since Roe versus Wade was passed, and that was back in 1973, over 66 million babies have been aborted in the United States? That's nearly one in five pregnancies terminated. With the abortion pill now available at local pharmacies and through the mail, a woman's bathroom now has become the scene of the crime. And that's where she tragically expels her child. We have to stop this, and you know how to do that. Preborn is a master at saving these babies and their moms. Go to preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Yes, sir. I would just say that I consider the hearing today my last act of service as a public servant for the United States of America. And I'll give you my professional opinion. I was an intel professional for our country for many years, and I would give recommendations, and I'd also look at indications and warnings. So I would offer this to the American people as my warning to them. Since this is a warning to the American people, I say, I personally have no confidence that the FBI will rein in its own conduct. I've been persecuted along with Garrett, Steve, and Kyle, and countless other whistleblowers. It is my opinion that the Bureau used reprisal and fear to control the workforce. It has been a seemingly effective tactic. I personally believe that there are no current effective checks and balances against them conducting lawless action with any type of correction in a legitimate time frame. I welcome the work of the IG, but I think any type of lawless action, there's no legitimate time frame to rein them back in. Their ability to overclassify information can allow them to stonewall forever. To the American people, you have a duty as a citizen to vote, and I strongly urge you to do so. It's how you participate in the American experience. I know people have doubts about election integrity, but you must vote. It is your claim. Stake your claim and don't forfeit it willingly.
All right. Well, that's the voice of an FBI agent whistleblower. You hear the emotion in his voice because he paid a tremendous price for speaking up. I'm not sure, honestly, if that's Marcus Allen or a guy named Terry Adberry, because there were two black FBI agents that were whistleblowers. But that's it gives you an idea of the price that these men and women are paying for stepping forward. There's a story for each of them. Steve Friend has been our guest more than one time. He paid a huge price for speaking up about what he saw in the FBI. And then that reminds me of that last set of whistleblowers that we talked about with Tristan, and that is the IRS whistleblowers. Catherine Herridge did a report on this, I don't know, some time ago, and I want you to hear her setup and then what they said about how it has affected their lives, and that would be Joe Ziegler and Gary Shapley, clip six.
This week, two IRS whistleblowers in the Hunter Biden investigation testified behind closed doors on Capitol Hill, and new documents were released by the GOP-led House Ways and Means Committee. The GOP committee claims the emails between 2010 and 2019 were sent by Joe Biden using at least three aliases when he was vice president or out of office to Hunter Biden and his business associates. The IRS whistleblowers again told CBS News standard procedures were not followed. What's the personal cost been of coming forward in the case?
You know, Catherine, people ask me that, and I've been asked that several times, and it's just I can't put my mind, I can't put it into words. It's going to affect me for the rest of my life, not in a positive way.
Yeah, it's had an effect on my life, my relationships, my husband, his business, being attacked for standing up for his husband who's gay. I mean, the depression that you go through, the isolation within the IRS, it's pretty I never thought that this would happen like this, but it's definitely an effect on me. And I know on Gary that you can't put words to.
So that was Joe Ziegler. And yes, I told you they're not conservatives, these IRS whistleblowers. And you heard Joe say that he's gay, has a same-sex husband, and Gary Shapley also. But they are men who love truth. And so they took the risk and they spoke up. And you also heard that they've been reinstated. They're doing incredible things. They're virtually in charge of the IRS now. That doesn't happen every time. But I just want to say in closing, these are heroes. These are men of courage. These are men with backbone, and women too. But we're talking mostly about men here. And I think it is time to step up. I'm not even talking about whistleblowing. I'm talking about courage. I'm talking about courage. This is a time for real courage. And I always think back to that sermon I heard probably a year ago at an event that I went to, and it was like a chapel service after the event. And a pastor preached this impassioned message about how important courage is to God. And he read a passage from Revelation that said that, you know, I don't have it in front of me, but there are no adulterers, no fornicators, a list like that. And no cowards will enter the kingdom of heaven. God takes cowardice very seriously, that seriously. Let's not be cowards. Let's be bold in our witness for the Lord Jesus. Let's be bold in trying to make things right in our own world, wherever we are, in difficult situations in our church, in our families. Let's be bold, but be bold and wise as serpents, of course, as God admonishes us in Scripture. Well, I want to thank you for listening. Tristan did a great job, and I hope you learned something. I certainly did on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.